It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. How many times in a restaurant have you wanted to order just the side dishes because they look so sexy? And of course, most of them are vegetarian. I mean, you know this. The hot stuff these days on chefs' tables is the produce. Well, we've got a British chef today who's actually become a star because of veggies. Of course, human nature being as contradictory as it is, we are also returning to meat. And not only eating it nose to tail, but butchering it ourselves. Well, we get a lesson today with a side of gestalt. Stick around. We're going to get into this and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is supported by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. A free trial and 10% off your first purchase at Squarespace.com with offer code SplendidTable4.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, do you remember once upon a time when a big hunk of grilled beef could win a chef star billing? Not anymore. Food's more complicated. Your aged beefsteak from a cow that ate only gold-plated grass is going to get some attention, but real celebrity is about what you do with everything else on the menu. One of London's young stars gained fame because of his vegetables. He's Yotam Ottolenghi, and his newspaper column, The New Vegetarian, took off like a rocket. So Yotam gathered those columns in a book that he's called Plenty, and he's joining us now. Yotam, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're not a vegetarian. Do you think that your food would be different if you didn't eat meat?
I think my food would be different if I didn't eat meat. If I was a vegetarian all my life, I think I would have thought that I'm missing out on something and tried to maybe compensate myself for not having that. And as a result, probably my food, my vegetarian food, would have been a little bit more with meat in mind, if you see what I mean. And I don't have that complex. I can eat whatever I like. So when I cook vegetables or when I write vegetarian recipes, I just celebrate everything that the vegetable world has to offer, rather than, you know, concentrate on what is lacking.
But don't you think that we've come to a point now where eating without meat is not something that's sort of separate from everything else? There's so much wonderful food out there that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with meat. And it's not about being vegetarian or not vegetarian. It's just good.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. People make all sorts of choices about what they eat nowadays, and this sort of distinction between vegetarians and meat eaters is much more fuzzy than it used to be, because people have all sorts of motivations. So the line is much more blurred, and I think it makes for a much more interesting world. And, you know, the whole big division between vegetarians and meat eaters was not good for both sides, because there was like two camps at war. And I think nowadays a lot of people realize you can do so much more exciting things without eating meat and still maybe not be 100% vegetarian.
What did you grow up eating and where did you grow up?
I grew up in Jerusalem in Israel. And I think I'm extremely fortunate because my parents are from a European background. My dad is Italian. My mother's from Germany. And at home, we had a very sort of quite a traditional European diet. But outside, it's all the beautiful flavors of the Middle East, the pulses, the beautiful vegetables, cheeses, nuts, lots of wild herbs, lots of garlic, citrus, all these flavors that are, you know, typical to that part of the world.
Well, I want to take you up to today. How do you build flavors? Because you're known for these bold flavors and very colorful dishes. And what I'd like to challenge you to do is to use a very commonplace ingredient. Scallions, for instance, which are all over right now.
Yeah, exactly. This is a great season, a great moment to speak about that because, you know, in the early spring, we have all these wonderful things. And I think that's often overlooked because, you know, what are scallions? It's something you maybe you chop up and sprinkle over a salad. But in actual fact, I sort of reverse the roles and I often take an ingredient that is sometimes or more often than not served as a flavoring to other things. And I use it wholeheartedly and fully with something else to make a dish. Oh, I do that with garlic. I can do it with a scallion, with an onion. You know, what it is I think it's about the method of cooking. It's opening your mind to different types of uses. For instance, if I would take a scallion, I first think color. I think it's green. Right. At least most of it is green. And I want to accentuate this element. So I would always marry it with things that are green or go well with green. It's sharp. And it's from the earth, so I always tend to want to add other vegetable flavors from it. I've recently published a recipe for a scallion soup, and in it I use zucchini, I use peas, I use a lot of garlic, all these sort of spring flavors that marry together with a scallion. But actually the scallion always stays in the center because I slow cook it, mm-hmm. The sweetness comes out, and then you have this wonderful combination of all those spring greens and the sweetness and sharpness of scallion. That's more or less how it works.
Interesting way to balance. There's an ingredient you use in your book that I love, and occasionally you find it growing wild in the United States, grape leaves. Yes. Talk about what you do with grape leaves.
Well, you know, there's so many things. I have a recipe, for instance, for yogurt stuffed vine leaves. Basically, it's yogurt that's being set with ground rice, and it's a Turkish recipe that I stumbled upon in a Turkish cookery book, and I tried and I just thought it's amazing. Again, a little bit like with the scallions, the center of this dish is actually the vine leaves themselves, and they're baked and slightly charred in the oven, and in combination with the sharpness of the yogurt, it's quite magical. It's not something that you would normally think is possible, but I tried and it worked.
So this is a pie that's stuffed with yogurt, and then you bake it.
Precisely.
Right? Yeah, you know, there is something that happens when you char those grape leaves or any bitter green. It is just it just takes on this edge that's so delicious.
Yes, when you char grilled vegetables, you hardly cook them at all. You give them a very nice smoky flavor, but actually inside it's all almost raw. And this combination of the freshness and the real flavor of the green, and then that sort of smoky, burnt flavor together is something that works. If you just take it and put it on the grill for a couple of minutes or blanch it quickly and then grill it, you leave everything inside and you can really enjoy it. And that also applies for how much you process it in terms of how I cut vegetables. I tend to keep my vegetables big and chunky so you can really see the vegetable in them. I much less like the sort of French tradition of all the cuts that actually make all vegetables look the same.
It's a good point. Jotam, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Jotam Ottolenghi's book is Plenty, and the recipe for that grape leaf herb and yogurt pie, that's on the website, splendidtable.org. You could use jarred grape leaves for this, but grape leaves are more prolific than mint, so keep your eyes open. So, the vegetable instead of meat is the big trend, but don't jump to conclusions. We humans are endlessly entertaining because we are impossible to pigeonhole. Julie Sabatier has an illustration of what I mean.
When you hear food activists in Portland, Oregon, together in a sentence, it might conjure up images of militant vegans protesting foie gras. But a different kind of activism has blossomed here in the past few years.
Meat, for me, is not just meat. That's a pretty strong metaphor for a lot of different parts of our culture. It's a political experience, it's an emotional experience, it can be a spiritual experience, it's an intellectual exercise, it's everything to me.
That's former food writer and self-described meat activist, Camis Davis. And she's not just talking about eating meat, she's talking about butchery.
I remember the New York Times published an article saying that the butcher was the new rock star. And that was really the moment where I thought, this is an important turning point. And I don't know if it's a good turning point or not, but it's clearly a turning point in the world of meat.
Around the same time that article was published, in the summer of 2009, Camus found herself at a turning point of her own. That's when she left the world of journalism and went to France to study butchery.
Because it was the scariest part of the food world, and it was the most hidden part of the food world, and it was kind of mysterious and kind of gory, and so to me it was the most interesting part.
Camus returned to Portland with a desire to spread the gospel of DIY butchering. She started the Portland Meat Collective. The PMC connects city dwellers with local farms where they can purchase whole animals. The collective also offers a series of classes to teach people how to butcher their own meat.
If everyone hasn't already passed your signed forms to me.
My name is Trey. I've been retail butchering for about 2 years.
Trey Satterfield led a pig butchering class on a Saturday afternoon in early January.
I didn't read Omnivore's Dilemma or anything like that. I kind of grew up in the rural area of North Carolina and wanted to get back to kind of like what I used to eat.
A half a dozen students paid $225 for 5 hours of instruction, hands-on butchery, and a hefty portion of meat to take home at the end of the day. The class took place in a giant industrial kitchen at the Art Institute of Portland's Culinary School. If you're wondering what kind of people an event like this attracts, the answer is all kinds. This particular gathering included a public defender, an x-ray tech, and an anthropology student working on a thesis about the Portland Meat Collective. Trey directed the group to the center of the room where half a pig lay on a shiny metal countertop. The pig came from a farm in western Oregon. It had been split lengthwise, cleaned, and gutted.
Guanciale. Who makes guanciale in here? Who wants to make guanciale? What's guanciale from? Camus went over it. You guys remember what she said?
It's that jowl.
It's the jowl piece. And what makes that so lovely? Why is the jowl better than the belly, maybe? Why does it taste better? Fat and exercise. Exactly. All day long. Eating each other, eating apples, eating, just eating. Like, I would be a pig. I would be a pig.
Trey worked through several different cuts of meat, belly, tenderloin, ribs, hocks, and trotters. She compared French and American styles and did a few demonstrations. After about an hour, it was time to bring out the other half of the pig so the students could get to work.
And you just kind of wiggle it in there, and we're going to pop that joint. Easy, easy, don't manhandle it. There you go. There.
That was it.
Bada bing, bada boom.
The class alternated between observing Trey and taking up the knives and meat saw themselves. Three volunteers wrapped cuts of meat as they came off the pig. At the end of the class, everyone came together to munch on charcuterie and divide up the spoils.
And is there anyone who doesn't want belly? Anyone who does not want bones for making stock?
Pretty much everyone who came to the pig class said they were motivated by a desire to get closer to the food they eat. And they all went away with a lot more knowledge about where a pork chop comes from. But according to Camus Davis, there's a more profound reason to learn how to butcher your own meat.
It makes you feel capable in the world. It makes you feel like you have access to something that most people don't. And it's a valuable, in my opinion, survival skill in some ways.
Julie Sabatier is creator and host of Public Radio's Destination DIY. And she's based in Portland, Oregon. You know, hearing mention of those pork bones reminded me of the butchering classes I used to teach long, long ago. You know, it makes me laugh to remember how we did all of these intricate French dishes, but the biggest hit? It was the snack that we improvised with the pork bones left over from the butchering. We coated them with what we found in the fridge, and it was apricot jam, mustard, vinegar, garlic, soy. You get the idea. We roasted them as we cleaned up. And then we just dug in. I mean, we gnawed on those bones and just groaned with happiness. So we've got the recipe for apricot mustard pork bones or ribs, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with what is really in that wine bottle. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is supported by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a professional-looking website or blog, offering mobile apps for updating a website or blog on the go, and a Twitter widget to display tweets in a customizable format. Squarespace is designed for all website needs. Build it, host it, and updated anytime. A free trial and 10% off your first purchase at squarespace.com. Offer code SplendidTable4. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. That bottle of Cabernet that you bought, well, it could be misleading. You see, it's probably not what you think it is, meaning it is not all Cabernet wine. Winemakers often blend grapes. Now, for why they do it and why we consumers should care, I've asked Ray Isle to come by. Ray is executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Ray, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
So, Ray, why do winemakers do blends?
Well, winemakers do blends essentially because it's a little like seasoning in a sense. If you have Cabernet, let's say you have a preponderance of Cabernet in your wine, but you need to soften the Cabernet a little bit. You may throw in some Merlot to give it a little, you know, sort of more lushness, or you may throw in a little Petit Verdot to kind of intensify the aroma. So it's a sense you're just kind of the same way you would with cooking. You're kind of adjusting the recipe a little bit to give a specific flavor you're looking for. And what consumers need to know, I mean, I think one thing, two things consumers need to know. One is that a huge number of wines are blends, whether they say Cabernet Sauvignon on the label or they say, you know, Folie du Ménage à Trois Red. So the interesting thing is that, you know, when you have a California wine, it only has to be 75% of what's on the label. So that wine that says Cabernet Sauvignon may have 20% Merlot in it, but the idea is to make it taste like Cabernet Sauvignon.
So essentially it is very much like cooking.
It's a lot like cooking. And, you know, oak is a seasoning too, oak barrels. That's a similar thing. If you use new oak, it gives a kind of – imparts a little bit of flavor to the wine. And like salt with cooking, you know, a lot of these things you want – if you don't use salt, you notice its absence. But if you do use salt, ideally you don't notice its presence. You don't want the food to taste really salty. But without it being there, you miss something. And that's kind of similar to what you're doing with winemaking.
Does this make it easier for the winemaker to make a good wine?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, all this comes out of in the far past, what you had is farmers would plant different varieties of grapes in the same vineyard, often that are ripened at slightly different times so that they kind of covered themselves in case there was any weird, you know, in case they got rain on October 20th, at least some of the grapes would have come in and been ripe. And they just sort of blended them together because that was what was growing in the vineyard. And nowadays, there's much more planting by variety and much more kind of conscious figuring out of what these blends might, you know, be or add to a wine. There's also a lot of creating wines that have catchy names and, you know, and are just blends of whatever sounds like it would go good together. So there's a little bit of mad scientist thing going on as well.
You know, I'm thinking when a dish is flat for a cook, okay?
Right.
One of the cures is always, you know, throw in tomatoes. It's going to taste better.
Right.
Are there sort of go-to blends or grapes for winemakers when they're running into difficulties?
Well, what there are, you know, there's go-to blending grapes for other grapes in a sense. So with Cabernet, kind of one of your go-tos is Merlot, to throw in a little Merlot. With Sauvignon Blanc, for instance, traditionally Semillon goes very well with it. It's a lot like foods, you know, salmon, you know, and dill go really well together. And similarly, the same thing happens with wine. Now, there's some grapes that are kind of resistant to blending, like Pinot Noir. Honestly, it's kind of itself, and it doesn't like to be blended with other things. It ends up being wonky tasting. But a lot of them blend very well. And sometimes they're funny combinations, too. Like, you know, I have some Chardonnays I've come across recently out of California have a little bit of Gewurztraminer blended in, which, you know, it's a weird Alsace grape. It doesn't make sense that it would be in there. But
Gewurz is a very spicy, distinctive grape, and Chardonnay tends to be this more
kind of
rich,
lush and soft and
yeah,
rich.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it's there for, is that little note of spiciness. And that makes it, you know, for the winemaker at least, what they're trying to do is make a wine that's really compelling.
Are there parts of the world that do blending much better than others?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that Europe, I mean, the tradition is much more blending than single variety. So, and it's historical, you know. The wines from Chianti are called Chianti. They're from Chianti, and they happen to be mostly Sangiovese plus, you know, Canaiolo plus whatever else. But that's because those are the grapes that grew in that area. So many of those sort of European regions we know really well, for instance, you know, Bordeaux or Rioja or Chianti, and so on, those are blended wines by nature. And in fact, by law, they're blended. They have to be. The EU regulations state that they have to be a certain blend. Champagne is typically a blend of red and white grapes, strangely enough.
But do any of these folks, you know, tend to do a better job? That, you know, if you go to Chile, you know, they blend wines in a way that really is appealing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think California is awfully good at making blended wines. That kind of knack for coming up with these blends that are seamless in a sense. I think California is awfully good. I think, you know, the classic regions are fantastic at it. Bordeaux is obviously they're masters at blending. You know, I think also Australia has been pretty smart at doing that. They've taken that Rhone variety specialization they have with Shiraz and Grenache and so on, and they've done really wonderful blends with it.
It's good to know. Hey, Ray, thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime.
Ray Isle is executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Of us who are up to here with cutting corners, Jane and Michael Stern are a help. These two find places to eat where prices make sense and the food makes you happy. They share their finds on their road food site and here. Jane, Michael, guys, what's the latest?
Lynn, have you ever been to Door County, Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a gorgeous area.
It is gorgeous.
Let me guess, you guys were there to eat fish boil?
Yes, we were.
I thought so.
Door County is proud of the fact that the fish boil is theirs and theirs alone, which isn't to say that you can't get one elsewhere. But according to their history, Door County is where it started, probably by the Icelandic ancestored fishermen who settled there many, many years ago. Nobody knows exactly how it started. But as you know, Lynn, it's a very specific ritual that involves cooking whitefish steaks with potatoes in a giant cauldron outdoors over an open fire, and it is distinguished by what is known as the boil over, which means that when everything is ready, the boil master takes a jug of kerosene and tosses it onto the fire so it just virtually explodes. The flames lick up, and there's a purpose to this other than to signal all who are standing around that dinner is about to be ready. The purpose is that the water, like, it sets the water to a very high boil, and supposedly what happens at that point is that all the sort of fat and stuff from the fish in the water boils over. So what you get is a very clean-tasting fish and clean-tasting potatoes to go with it.
And singed eyebrows.
Well, if you're standing too close, yes.
Well, it's really one of the most dramatic food ways in America. I mean, I used to think flaming poo-poo platters were fabulous, but the first fish boil I saw, which was done as the sun was setting, and it's this giant bonfire, and then you get to eat the food afterwards, what comes out of the bonfire.
And one of the essential elements of a traditional Door County fish boil is that as the fish is cooking and the people who are about to eat it gather around, nobody makes a fish boil for a family. This is always for large groups of people.
Right,
but
right.
As people are gathered and as the stuff is cooking in the giant cauldron, there must be an accordionist on duty who plays music for everyone to enjoy while you're waiting for the fish to be ready.
So what does this taste like? It's a big stew, right?
Well, yeah, it's not just fish.
Well, it's not served as a stew. I mean, basically, once it comes out of the water, you get a plate with these beautiful white fish steaks on it, along with the red potatoes and a salad and always cherry pie for dessert from local cherries, actually. So it's a fish platter that is cooked in such a way that the seasoning is like, it's hard to describe. It's the fish itself. I mean, you cannot identify any other specific seasoning.
Oh, I know a seasoning you can identify.
Salt?
A ton and a half of salt.
They use massive amounts of salt, which, of course, is to get the water boiling better. But what's amazing is that while the fish is salty, it's just salty enough. It's not overly salty. And when you see them pour the salt into this cauldron, you think, oh, my gosh, this is going to be the saltiest meal ever. But it is not.
And it makes the potatoes wonderful,
yeah.
Really wonderful. It's like salt, you know, potatoes that are baked in salt.
Oh,
like salt
that,
and potatoes,
yeah.
is a wonderful combo.
Where do you go to get this?
There are several places all along Door County. And in fact, if you're going at the height of summer, you want to call and make a reservation in advance. Our favorite place is in a town called Fish Creek. It's the White Gull Inn. And they have been doing fish boils for decades. They really know how to do it. It's very entertaining. Their accordionist is the best. I mean, it is just tons of fun. And that cherry pie for dessert is not to be missed.
This sounds wonderful.
It's fun.
Thank you, guys. Bye, Lynn.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Stern's latest book is Road Food. It's an update of their seminal Sleeves Up Dining Guide. Now, for their finds of the moment, check out splendidtable.org.
Call me if you're feeling lonely, call me if you're feeling blue. If you don't believe me, call and say you need me. And darling, I will come to you. Call me.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Get to us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Let's see, who are we going to talk to first? We've got Katrina calling from Baltimore.
Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk about a lemon. Just one.
Just one?
Just one. My boyfriend grows a bonsai lemon tree in his apartment, and he can only get it to produce about one lemon a year. And it's about time for that one lemon to be picked and eaten somehow, but we don't know what to do with it. We want to do something that really features the lemon and respects how rare it is.
Now, I have to know, so a bonsai is tiny. Is the lemon?
The lemon is about one-third the size of the tree.
Oh, for goodness sake. Okay, all right, let's think now. We have a small lemon.
Yes, also the caveat that it needs to be a vegetarian item.
So. Oh, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. This is what I'm wondering. What do you think about the idea of taking that lemon? I'm thinking of using the entire lemon, you know, the rind.
Yes, that's
and the
great.
Whole thing. Yeah, but this is what I'm wondering. Wouldn't it be interesting to take that lemon, slice it crosswise, absolutely paper thin,
mm-hmm.
now, and sort of candy it? So what? This is what you do. You toss those paper thin slices of lemon with sugar, okay,
mm-hmm.
and let it sit overnight because that's going to have the sugar permeate into the lemon.
Right. So you just let it sit out on the counter just at room temperature.
That's right. You toss it with a generous amount of sugar. You paper thin slice it first.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in a glass bowl because you don't mm-hmm. want to put it in anything that's going to react with the acid.
Right.
And you just let it sit out overnight and it's going to produce a lot of juice.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you can do is take that lemon and spread it out sort of overlapping like a pinwheel or like fish scales
mm-hmm.
on a piece of pastry that you've just Ooh. Rolled out flat. And you can bake that and you can have that as a little mini tart that the two of you share.
Oh, yum.
You know, and you could pre-bake the pastry if you wanted to, just lightly,
mm-hmm.
so it stays crisp. And another thing you might want to do when you absolutely finish the tart and it's done,
mm-hmm.
sprinkle a tiny bit of fresh lemon juice on it, and that'll be that final sparkle.
Okay.
Okay? See what happens.
Yeah,
I think it'll be a lovely thing.
Sure, and just puff pastry dough, or what kind of pastry?
I would use like a pie pastry that has a bit of sugar in
okay.
it. Okay. Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy the lemon.
All right.
Bye.
Have a good one. Bye.
You too. Call us 800-537-5252. Elliot is on the line from Minneapolis. Elliot, hi. What's up?
Hi. Well, I've been making a lot of my own beverages lately, and now that spring's rolling around, I've rediscovered lavender.
Oh, yeah.
And it was actually some lavender ice cream that reminded me how wonderful it is. But I'm trying to infuse lavender into some beverages, so ranging from soda water all the way to kind of like a light champagne.
That's a great idea. So are you and actually making your own champagne, or you're adding it to a champagne?
Well, I'm making my own, but I think that it's a wonderful addition for anyone who would just be adding it also.
I have to ask you, how are you making your own champagne? Are you doing the entire process?
Yeah, it's actually remarkably simple. So I've been brewing my beer, or my own beer, with friends for a long time. And
right.
We thought, well, hey, let's use some high-quality apple cider and wine yeast, or a champagne yeast in there. And it actually fermented all the way through to about 16 or 18% alcohol, and we bottled that up and added a tiny bit of sugar at the end, and the sugar in the bottle, the yeast converts that into a little more alcohol and into a lot of carbon dioxide, and that actually carbonates the cider.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the lavender. One of the tricks with any herb or anything that you want to, you know, get the flavor of it into something is to blend it if you're using the sugar, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would rub the lavender into that sugar, a lot of it, and let it really permeate the sugar, because then the sugar will have an intense lavender fragrance and flavor. And then if you want to, you can sift out the lavender buds, but that sugar might do the trick.
Is this fresh lavender or is this dry lavender?
It could be either one. Now, dried lavender is going to be more intense. So I would go with the dried because it's more concentrated. Yeah, that's where I'd start. That's the trick. You know, when, for instance, when you're doing desserts and you want the flavor of an herb or a flower in it, that's how you go about doing it. And you use a ton of that ingredient with the sugar, and then you sift it out, and then you use the sugar. Well, since you're using the sugar to produce the alcohol, I have a feeling it'll leave us with a flavor of lavender.
Absolutely wonderful.
Well, let's hope so. So, hey, let us know how it works.
I will definitely let you know, and thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Have a good one.
You too. Isn't that a great idea? I think we need a little research on this, but making our own bubbly? I like this. Okay. Call us, 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, what was the newest award given by the San Pellegrino World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards this year? Well, we're going to return with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email us at splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the newest award given out this year by the San Pellegrino World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards? Well, believe it or not, the award was for the world's best female chef. So I guess the other awards they gave were for only the best male chefs. Chef Anne-Sophie Pique of France's Maison Pique was the winner. She also holds the highest restaurant rating in France, 3 Michelin stars. The woman's a major talent. But there's a rub here. With 1,500 three-star awards that Michelin has given out in its 79 years, Ms. Pique is only the fourth woman to get this. Well, Mademoiselle Pique, congratulations. Veuve Clicquot Champagne, who owns San Pellegrino, shame on you. You've forgotten your origins. Veuve Clicquot means the widow Clicquot, and she was the first woman to build a great champagne house. Today, you are still run by a woman. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Dina is on the line from Shoreline, Washington. Dina, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. My daughter's school has a school auction like so many of them do.
Right.
And my husband thought it was a great idea for us to auction off an Italian dinner for 6 to 8 people. And so we did. And so now I got to figure out what to make. I have some great recipes. I'm from an Italian family, and one of the things I like is we make a Italian gravy that has sausage and ribs and and meatballs.
Yeah, yeah.
And very, very rich, very heavy. I also do flour gnocchi or ricotta gnocchi. I don't do potato gnocchi.
You don't need me. You've got everything.
I just can't decide.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, okay. What would you do if your family were having a special meal? What would be on the table?
Oh, gosh. It depends on how much time and what kind of mood I'm in.
Okay. So these people have paid a good amount of money, I would imagine. And if they haven't, they should have. All right. And you want them to really feel special. Not many people make the classic gravy that you're describing.
Okay.
I mean, that is a thing of joy. And maybe what you want to do, how do you normally use that gravy? I mean, do you take the meats out and serve them as a separate course, which some people do, or do the meats just get broken up in the sauce and then you have meatballs and you serve that all together?
We've kind of pulled the meats out on a separate platter and
right.
then served the sauce and pasta and served it all together.
Then you know what I would do? This is what I would do. Do a light antipasti. You know, something that they can nibble while they have drinks. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And it could be really as simple as having tiny cubes of good salami and some nice olives and some salted nuts. You know,
okay.
maybe you take almonds and you roast them in the oven with some olive oil and herbs.
Oh, yum.
And you could dress your own olives. You could do a little orange zest and some basil and maybe a little touch of red pepper if that's part of your tradition. And the idea is that you'd rinse the olives, you know, from whatever they come from the store in, and then you'd dress them with some good-tasting olive oil and these other things, and you let them sit overnight, and then bring them to room temperature. So it's your little touches, but this is not a lot of work. You don't want to knock yourself out on the antipasti because you're going to really deliver big time when they sit down. And then it's true, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So when they sit down, what would normally be if you were to do a first course when people sit down? Because do you want to – I mean, pasta is often a first course, but it sounds like you do it as a main dish.
Yeah, I want to do the pasta with that rich tomato sauce.
Oh, I think it would be so good.
So good.
I mean, my mouth is watering. Good Lord. Okay, maybe even – you know, usually salad is served at the end of the meal, but maybe it might be nice to sit down to a salad.
Uh-huh.
And that salad could be some tart greens because – You're setting them up with something really fresh because they're going into something really rich. And then I don't know what you'd like to do for dessert, but you might want to have something in between. You might want to have a platter of fresh fruit or dried fruits and nuts that everybody can kind of nibble on. Or you might want to serve just a little bit of cheese.
Now, I'm afraid of going too heavy on dessert. I mean, I'd love to do like tiramisu or something, but is that going to be too heavy and rich?
I think if you want to make a switch here and you do the salad right afterward and you maybe sit them down to some simple vegetable, some grilled zucchini strips with peppers and garnish it with capers and do some squeezed lemon over it, and that could be your starter. And then, I know what you're thinking, we should do something light for dessert after a meal like that, but who doesn't love tiramisu?
Okay.
I would do it. Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a great dinner.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
What Dina is describing, this sauce that's made with whole chunks of meat, rib, like for instance, you know, ribs of pork and chunks of lamb and beef and sausages. This is such a great tradition. You find it generally in the regions of southern Italy, and it is a wonderful way to eat because you make it ahead, and then what some people do is they take the sauce, and that goes with pasta as a first course, and then they take the meats, which have, you know, they're the best pot roast you've ever eaten in your life, and that goes on a platter, and you serve it as a second course, and you could just have that with a salad to freshen it up. Unbelievable. easiest way to have a feast that I can think of. Okay, contact us. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. Beta downloads our podcasts, and she came up with an interesting question. She explained that she doesn't know much about wine, and she's a vegan. And when it comes to pairing wine, most of the information is about how to pair wine with meat. So how do you pair wine with vegan foods? It's the exact same premise, Beta. This is the way it works. It's taste to taste. So, for instance, you're eating sweet peas with onion and olive oil and salt and pepper and garlic. So the dominant taste there is the sweetness of the peas. So what you want is a wine that has a hint of sweetness. And in this case, it would probably be a Riesling. It's a white, you serve it cool, it's really fresh, and with spring peas, it's just the perfect marriage. Then if you have something really robust, like, for instance, you've marinated tofu in red wine, garlic, lots of herbs, well, that's where a Merlot or a Shiraz would work. These are hearty, big reds, and you've got those bigger flavors. So just think basic taste. If it tends to be very savory, brown tastes, that's where you can go for reds. If it tends to be very delicate, but no sweetness, that's where you might want to go for something like a Chardonnay. When it has a hint of tartness to it, go for a Sauvignon Blanc, because that has a real crisp sort of green apple quality. And when it has a hint of sweetness to it, go for a Riesling, because that usually has a real fruity sweetness to it. That's it. It's really easy. And thanks for contacting us. You can contact us too, and you can download our podcasts, splendidtable.org. While you're there, shoot us an email. Barry is on the line from Louisville, Kentucky. Barry, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about Kentucky country ham.
Ooh, yeah.
And last Thanksgiving, I was at went to my hometown, and there's a little town near there in western Kentucky, and there's a Newsom's Old Mill store, and they have been doing country hams for years. And recently, in the past few years, it's gained notoriety, and it's being served at some of the finer the restaurants here in Louisville. And this is special ham, so I want to do something special with it. And the instructions that's provided, you can either boil it or bake it,
right,
and then remove the rind and then put a glaze on. And I was wondering what is the best method and any ideas for a glaze for it.
I have to tell you, you are talking about one of my very favorite hams. I mean, I say it with reverence because I had the privilege a long time ago of meeting the uncle or the father of Nancy Newsom, who now runs the business. And this is just a wonderful ham. You know, okay, let's think. Obviously, it's going to be a strong flavor, but their hams are so good. In fact, they do hams you can actually eat raw as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they do a prosciutto-style ham, and it's really probably not very different in the cure from their regular hams, but it's aged a bit. Okay, this is one of the ways that I like to do ham. What I like to do is to first, you know, put it in a pot. You cover it. Really, you want to put it in a pot of simmering water, okay? Mm-hmm. And you want to leave it there for maybe an hour at a very, very gentle simmer, okay? And that helps get a bit of the salt out of it. And then you take off that skin. You want to leave a nice, you let it cool a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this a day ahead. And then you take off the skin, all right? But you want to leave that layer of fat.
Okay.
And what you want to do the day you're going to serve it is do a slow roast on it at about 325, because you just want to heat it all the way through. Okay? And the thing is, you want to do a slow roast, and I would baste it with, of all things, port wine and red wine.
Oh, wow.
Because the combination is really delicious. And then if you want to, you can do a mixture of the port with grainy mustard, a bit of vinegar, and garlic.
Mm.
And then you want brown sugar in there,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a jam. And you would spread that on it the last half hour or so, and even run it under the broiler if you need to get a glaze. The pan juices are going to be salty, but that port with the red wine just tends to bring up all the flavor of the ham.
Wow.
And then you get that sweet, kind of complex, interesting glaze on it that'll complement the ham. And you know how to serve it. You do it paper thin.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a 14-pound ham, so I don't know that we'll use it all. How do you store it?
You know the old line that eternity is two people and one ham. Yeah. But I think, first of all, you want someone to saw it in half for you. Is it bone in or bone out?
It's bone in.
It's bone in. You need somebody to saw it in half for you, and you want to saw it right across the middle. And I think I would check with Newsom's what they think. Could you hang it in a cool place, or should you just put it in the freezer?
Mm.
And ask them what they think, because they know their hams.
Oh, I can't wait.
It's going to be good.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Check us out on Facebook. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. I don't think it's a coincidence that interest in heirloom seeds has taken off and America's oldest seed company is being revived. And this is happening more or less at the same time. Landreth Seed Company in Philadelphia sold seeds to every president from George Washington to FDR. Well, now they've teamed with a food historian, Michael Twitty. He works in African-American food before and after emancipation. And with him, Landreth has the first African-American heritage seed collection. Well, Michael is with us. Michael, welcome.
Hello, Lynn.
So what kinds of seeds are in this collection?
Oh, the usual suspects plus some. There's, for example, cowhorn okra, one of the oldest okras. There's fish pepper from the Chesapeake area. There are brown crowder peas from Mississippi. There are Charleston cabbages, the kind that used to go in Charleston bird soup from South Carolina. There's everything from Creole to Gulf Coast to Chesapeake to Tennessee, the Midlands to Missouri. This is the entire botanical story of the African American people laid out in the collection. Not every single seed, but enough so that one gets a taste of what history was like.
Now, did these seeds originally come from Africa?
That's the frequently asked question. Some of them would have, and others came through Africa. I think it's very important to mention there are a lot of New World foods that were paired with African antecedents, and those New World foods kind of, they didn't always took over, but they were definitely very popular, and they came to the Americas on slave ships. Now, I think it's crucial to mention that enslaved Africans themselves rarely brought any seeds of their own. Most of the time, these were seeds and plants and foods that were brought specifically to feed the enslaved workforce. In other words, the slave traders were catering to the taste of enslaved workers. And first, that worked very beautifully in Brazil and the West Indies, where the climates are all tropical.
Right.
But in the Americas, that was a slow progression. So there were some things coming directly from Africa. There were some things that came through the West Indies into the South. And there were other things that took their time, like sorghum.
But I would imagine that at that time, a landowner would essentially say to slaves, you'll eat whatever I give you. To go to the effort of bringing food that your workers are used to just doesn't seem to fit with the image we have.
Well, we have a very skewed image of what power was like. Some historians caution us against giving too much power to the enslaved. And I, on the other hand, think it's all relative. I think when it comes to matters of language and religion, we certainly see a lot of oppressive behavior. When it comes to food, however, there's tremendous flexibility. Josiah Collins, one of the original owners of Somerset Place Plantation in North Carolina, which is still standing, it's Creswell, North Carolina, one of the wealthiest plantations in American history, when he brought over 87-some workers from probably southern coastal Ghana, within a year he has to order 1,000 red pepper pods because they're not eating this bland English-style food. They're eating the food they're used to. And I think it's important to remember These gardens, these foods were used as a way to placate, to assuage the process of these people being in exile and being worked, not for their own benefit. You have to do something. So in the larger picture that's emerging is that, you know, enslaved Africans made the sort of demands that they understood to be reasonable, because those were the same things that they found in their own culture. Enslaved Africans in Africa had certain requirements, demands, and obligations that they expected from the part of their owners, and enslaved Africans in America made those similar demands. So what we're looking at is a picture of food and slavery that is not so much the master throws down the food so much as it is the enslaved people determine the definition of the food.
A very different point of view.
Yes.
Michael, thank you.
You're quite welcome, Lynn.
Food historian Michael Twitty and the Landreth Seed Company created the first African-American heritage seed collection. Now, for more information, just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And until next time, let me leave you with this from H. Fred Dale, who said, "My green thumb came only as a result of the mistakes I made while learning to see things from the plant's point of view." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org, for additional information on anything you heard here today. And check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three Interviews with Star Cooks, that is, good cooks and chefs, talking about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz, with help from Chris Peters. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.